Mark Riley, Sarah Eisen, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Mark, so much oxygen has been consumed in recent weeks by the infighting between the Liberals and the Nationals over net zero. And while that's been happening, One Nation has been surging in the polls. That's perhaps the biggest story of the past few months. What do you think explains this newfound popularity of Pauline Hanson and her party?
Well, the newfound unpopularity, Nick, of the coalition. The disaffected Libs and Nats are parking their votes on the right, and I think One Nation is the logical off-ramp for those people. It's a protest, essentially. But what we shouldn't forget, though, that polls, particularly this part of the electoral cycle, about as useful as a screen door in a nuclear submarine. It was proved that way before the election. Remember, Peter Dutton was going to win 30 seats and be prime minister, and he lost in a historical fashion. So we can't get too carried away about polls. It's a temperature check at a point in time, and at a point in time without really any consequence in the way people say they're going to vote. Not as many people who say they're supporting One Nation today would support One Nation at an election. That said, very bad trend for the coalition parties, but I mean, an obvious and logical byproduct from a coalition of two parties who are fighting among themselves and then among each other over the spoils of defeat. It's about as knuckleheaded as politics gets.
I totally agree with you about polls, especially at this time in the electoral cycle. I think in Australia we just spend far too much time obsessing about polls. But what makes this interesting is these are record numbers, Sarah, for One Nation, higher than it achieved nationally when it first emerged in the 1990s. What do you think lies behind this poll surge for Pauline Hanson?
I think there's a few things. I think, you know, people are attracted to a party that has doubled its numbers of senators at the last election. At the same time, you've got a former deputy prime minister being quite open about the fact that he might even want to join One Nation. That's been a whole bit of reporting recently of Barnaby Joyce. It's not exactly looking like some... It's just a minor party that no one's thinking about or talking about. It seems to have relevance to people. So that's one thing. The second thing, it knows who it is. Pauline Hanson knows who she is. They know who they are. There's not this same tug of war between this, you know, existential crisis of the mods and the conservatives in the coalition or in the Liberal Party more specifically, and people who might be conservatives or feel like they're on the conservative side of politics don't know what the Liberal Party stands for and don't know where it's going to end up after the whole soul-searching moment that it has.
Mark, around the Western world right now, we're seeing what's being called the great realignment of the right. Donald Trump in America, Nigel Farage in Britain, National Rally is now the most popular party in France. The far-right AfD is the most popular party in Germany. Australia has a democratic model with compulsory voting that generally means elections are fought in the centre. But is that orthodoxy now being challenged?
Look, it is being challenged because I think the far right is now the home of grievance in politics, and people are gravitating there. Like people who you would normally think, even in Australia, would be the rusted on blue collar heartland of the Labor Party, have shifted from the left of the Labor Party to the far right of the Conservative parties. And that's a shift that's been happening fairly steadily, I think, since around 2004 elections. We've seen that happening. But look, compulsory voting is, you know, it stabilizes our democratic architecture. It is the thing that keeps us apart. It means that there won't be such an extreme shift in not just voting intention, but voting outcome. So we saw in the last election, the Prime Minister has a massive majority, 51% majority in the House of Representatives. It's very, very broad, but it's also in a lot of parts very shallow, and it wouldn't be that if it weren't for compulsory voting. We have a turnout of around, voter turnout of 90%, Nick, you know, and I think in the US, what, the midterms recently was just under 50%. The peak of the presidential elections in 2020 was around 65 or 66. So that is the natural stabiliser for our democracy.
Sarah, it's not just the electoral system that keeps Australian politics in the centre, it's the political geography as well. This is a very urbanised electorate. In cities, politics tends to be more moderate. And for the Liberals to regain power, you'd think they'd have to start winning some seats with a view of Sydney Harbour. Electoral geography also keeps politics in the centre.
I find this conversation fascinating because it's so divisive among the Liberal Party. There's so big a sentiment in the Conservative ranks that moderates across the party, across the country, are going to use this moment of existential crisis to capitalise and move the party in a direction that suits them, and that's that inner city mainstream views and so on. And the Conservatives, almost like a sense of paranoia or conspiracy around that, whereas different people, mostly moderates but definitely some Conservatives as well, have a bigger picture view of where they want to win the seats of a numbers game. So you're seeing all kinds of different views of the world play out among the Liberal Party. It's really how you see the future, reality, the world, and that it's almost like people are speaking a different language at times when we're having these discussions with Liberal sources.
On ABC Radio National, I'm Nick Bryant, and this is Saturday Extra, and I'm talking with Mark Riley, the political editor of Seven News, and Sarah Eisen, a senior reporter with The Australian. Let's talk about what's happening within the coalition, within the Liberal Party especially. And it's related, as you say, to the rise of One Nation. Mark, a few weeks ago, there was a certain amount of conjecture whether or not Susan Lee would survive the so-called killing season. I hate that phrase, but we use it virtually every year, it seems. Am I right in thinking, though, that her position at least until the end of this year is a little bit more secure?
Yes, so I think it is. But look, I've always thought, Nick, and politics often proves me wrong, but I've often thought, though, that it would be a special kind of genius who thought it was a good idea to knock off the first elected female leader of the Liberal Party ever, who was celebrated as such, 6 months ago, within 6 months? And 2 years out from an election, I just don't see what the point of that would be, unless she was egregiously bad in her position, or she had done something completely awful. Neither of which I believe are true. So, and for the Liberal and National parties at the moment, this is a time they should have been spending on soul searching about connecting with those voters, as Sarah was talking about, the urban voters. How do you reconnect with them? What did they want at the last election? What didn't they want from the last election? And how does your policy suite suit the needs and aspirations of those voters who ultimately will determine your success? And there is a review that's underway now. It hasn't reported yet. And even before the review is out, they're tearing themselves apart. Now, why is that? Because they did reach that existential moment after the election when they had the leadership ballot and Susan Lee won on the basis of the support from the moderates, in the broad church of the Conservative Party, those on the left side pews, and then and some Conservatives, and now the numbers are kind of shifting a little bit behind it because people are anxious about the way they are in those in the polls, and that they seem to be going backwards, not forwards. And the Conservatives are now being very, very muscular. That posse of well-dressed hitmen who marched into the party room on the day the energy policy was determined, behind three Conservative women, just to soften their appearance a little bit, was a pretty stark message. It just said, we've got the numbers now, we can do you anytime we want to. And I think that's the reality for Susan Lee. I think she should be given time. Whether she can, the febrile nature of politics, and particularly we're coming into the last week, as you said, the killing season, I like you hate that, but it's sort of got a life of its own, and almost a self-fulfilling prophecy in ways, and illogical things occur in that final week. It is a very intense atmosphere, and anything could happen, but I think it'd be wrong of the Conservative parties to ditch a leader at this point.
I mean, Sarah, what Mark was saying there is she survives until Christmas, but it seems that sometime next year she'll be gone. Is that your assessment?
Well, I think it's very much if you have a leader who's polling incredibly badly, regardless of their gender, if you want to make a change, you can't make that change too close to an election. And of course, it's in Labor's hands about how early said election could be. So, yeah, I think that's very much a live option next year. I do agree with Mark. There is a concern about not wanting to be seen as pushing a woman out really unfairly. And to be honest, I've heard this from Liberal sources that I wouldn't expect to. Let's call them the most, I don't know, bolshy kind of source that I wouldn't have expected this sense of, I don't want to look like I'm, you know, doing this to our first female Liberal leader. That's not what I was expecting. So there is really that sense, be it for completely political reasons of the optics, but very much not wanting to do that prematurely.
Let's wrap this up with what the Labor government's been up to at the moment and the COP climate change summit. The Albanese government have been lobbying to host next year's summit in South Australia. Turkey is going to get the hosting rights. I mean, Mark, there seems something sort of very half-hearted about the Australian bid. I mean, are they kind of almost relieved that they're not going to have to host COP next year?
Yeah. Well, there's certainly some members of the government who were very relieved, Nick, when they started to see the price tag. You know, it's going to cost taxpayers something like $2 billion to host this. So South Australia wanted to be good for their local economy, but for federal taxpayers, it's not a very good...
How do you spend $2 billion on a summit?
Well, you know, Pauline Hanson had this wonderful line this week, where at first you've got to find a way to house 644 private jets. That's how many private jets the environmentalists took to the last COP prior to the present one in Brazil. But you've got a lot of organisation. You have to find function halls, a lot of accommodation and the rest of it, the administration costs. It's a massive, massive undertaking. Having been to a lot of these things since the first one I went to was in Bali in 2007. I even went to Copenhagen, the snow-blown disaster in Copenhagen in 2009. I don't know why any self-respecting, right-thinking city would want to have anything to do with a COP. It is just a mess. But anyway, I think the government did want to do it. I think it was partially a vanity project for Anthony Albanese, but he came up against somebody else who was running a similar thing, and that's Erdogan, whose wife is an environmentalist, and there's this sort of word going around the ministerial wing, sotto voce, that this is all about not Erdogan, but his wife. She really wants COP. And so you have this agreement now that the government said is such a great deal for Australia that Turkey will be the host of COP, so it'll actually be in their country, but Chris Bowen will get this role, manufactured role. He'll be the president for administration, essentially, which sounds like the secretary's role. He'll do all the stuff that the president doesn't want to do, and that this is a great victory. Well, in the end, you know, there was a two-horse race. We came last, and we got a participation certificate for coming last. That's about it.
Sarah, was this a cop-out?
I think there was a pretty concerted effort to get this done. There was surprise within Labor ranks and government ranks that, you know, often what happens with a COP is once enough countries are on the side of a country to host, which seemed to be in Australia's favour at a time, it's just the done thing that the other competing country bows out. And that didn't happen. I think it was a surprise the way Turkey conducted itself and ultimately in a way that it was successful. I think it's a silver lining in some way, but I do think it is being considered as somewhat of a loss by many within the government, particularly the left faction ranks of the Labor Party.
Well, enjoy the final sitting week of the parliamentary year. Mark Riley of 7 News and Sarah Eisen of The Australian. Thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Cheers.
Good on you, Nick. Thanks.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.